Welcome. Thank you for coming to the Migration Policy Institute this morning and to our book event, our glorious book event on the young children of black immigrants in America, changing faces and changing flows. My name is Michael Fix. I'm the senior vice president here at MPI, and I co-direct what we call our National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy. I want you to know, and I've been told to tell you, that our event is being live streamed this morning. And so the question and answer that will follow the presentations that we have will be included in the video that we will post on our website after the event. And our website address is www.migrationpolicy.org. Let me just say a little bit about the origins of this project. About 2 years or so ago, MPI, we were approached by Ruby Takanishi, and Ruby was the then president of the Foundation for Child Development. And she said that the foundation was interested in developing a new project on examining the largely unchartered terrain of young children of black immigrants. And by young, what we mean is birth to around age 10. While the literature at the time on children of immigrants' development, particularly as it pertains to Hispanics and to a slightly lesser extent Asians, was growing rapidly, and while we had a fairly robust literature at the time on adolescent children of black immigrants coming from Mary Waters at Harvard and some other excellent scholars, studies of young children of birth to 10, that field would still remain largely unexamined. So what we did is we put together an annotated bibliography, which is on our website. We identified potential authors for papers and then for chapters for the book that you have on your chair, your free book that you have on your chair. At the suggestion of two young scholars of the Foundation for Child Development, Kevin Thomas and Mashari Keels, we did something quite unusual for us. We had a call for papers, and the call for papers, the broad call for papers, yielded some of the absolute best, most interesting papers that are in the book before you. And then we took our communication director, Michelle Mittelstadt's very good advice to start to release the papers one by one. So if you look at our website, you'll see seven of the papers that are in the volume published there. And to our, I think, surprise, to my surprise at least, these papers found and built a really strikingly large audience. They've been downloaded more than 100,000 times already. We had a conference around the papers to which a number of you came and helped us think through the volume. And then we set sail in putting the book together. And as we started to put the book together, a number of framing characteristics of the population, of this black immigrant population, really came clear to us. And they'll come clear in the presentations here today. But let me just say briefly, first and foremost here is the growth of this population. From 2000 to 2010, African migration to the United States was the fastest growing flow of all migrant flows to the United States. As a result, what we see is that the share of the total black child population that children of black immigrants represent went from just 2% in 1970 to about 12% today. Struck, of course, by the generally high education level of black immigrants to the United States and by the high levels of English proficiency. Not just English proficiency, but native English and fluent English proficiency among the population. 75% of black immigrants speak are fluent or native English speakers. And then, importantly, for integration-related reasons, we're struck by the different channels of entry of black immigrants to the United States, entering under the diversity visa program, entering as refugees, being sheltered under the temporary protected status program, as well as entering through the more traditional channels of family and work into the United States. And while I am on the subject of refugees, I want to take this opportunity to recognize the director of the Office of Refugee Resettlement, who has helped us, Eskinder Nagash, who has helped us with this project all along and who has been a friend of the project and a friend of MPI, as well as Ken Toda, a senior official in the department. We're really pleased to have you guys with us today. Let me just say a word about the quite colorful book that is on your chairs. I don't think we need this. As Randy Capps and Kristen McCabe and I sat down to craft the introduction to the book, to try to pull all these papers together, it seems to us that there were really five framing issues that were addressed at one point or another through the book and that really represented the contribution of the papers in the book. First, we wanted to explore the origins and the characteristics of the black immigrant population and their implications for children's well-being. Second, the book looks into children of black immigrants' birth outcomes and their childhood health. A third focus of the book is children of black immigrants' families' access to public benefits and services, with a special focus on early childhood education and child care and health insurance. And fourth, a fourth area of focus is children of black immigrants' early developmental outcomes and their readiness for kindergarten. And then finally, the final two chapters of the book, Dylan has written one of them, looks at children of black immigrants' academic performance in elementary school. We think the book is useful because it brings together a wide range of disciplines. It's all the way from education, economics, to anthropology. It taps a wide range of data sources, from the usual suspects like the American Community Survey to less usual suspects. There is a very interesting paper in here that's based on a longitudinal local data survey in Palm Beach County, which has a heavily Haitian population, that was conducted by the University of Chicago's Chapin School. And what you'll see if you look at the book, and a real focus of it, is this comparative framework that it uses to assess the well-being of children of black immigrants and to compare them to other first and generation children of immigrants, Latino immigrants, children of white immigrants, children of Asian immigrants. And it's the comparisons in the book, I think, when all is said and done, when we looked at them, were really quite sobering when you looked at child well-being within some of those comparison groups. So while the book is nominally about children of black immigrants, it is very much about the comparison populations and how they're doing as well. Let me just say a word about our panel this morning. It is my own personal dream panel. You have their bios before you, but I do want to take this opportunity to sing some of their praises. So I'll introduce them in the order in which they'll speak. First, I'll begin with Kevin Thomas. Kevin is a star in the prestigious sociology department and Pop Study Center at Penn State University, and he's certainly one of the nation's leading demographic experts on black migration to the United States and in general. We'll turn then to my co-editor, Randy Capps. Randy's a senior policy analyst and demographer here at MPI, and with one of our other co-panelists, A.J. Chaudhry. They wrote what has to be one of the Urban Institute's most read and most influential reports on the impact of immigration enforcement on immigrant children and families. Then we'll hear from Dylan Conger. Dylan's a professor and the master of the public policy program at George Washington University, and she wrote what I think is really one of the most interesting and provocative chapters in the book about the educational progress of black immigrant children, and in particular Haitian children, in the Miami-Dade school system. The Miami-Dade school system is the second largest in the United States. We'll turn then to Gerald James. Gerry's a distinguished professor in both Yale's economics and African American studies department. He is much lauded. He has many achievements, but among them I would only single out is he was the editor of the landmark National Academy of Sciences volume, A Common Destiny, Blacks in American Society, that was published on the 25th anniversary of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Then we'll conclude with A.J., A.J. Chaudhry. A.J. is the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Human Services in the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation at HHS. He has been helping us with this project from its inception and guided us all along. And in addition to being a major government domo, A.J. is also one of the nation's leading experts in immigration and immigrant children and in their integration. So I'm going to turn to Kevin. We are going to shoot to go to noon, but we're scheduled to go to 12:15. We'll go there if it makes sense. Kevin?
Thank you very much. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. What I want to do this morning is to try to provide a demographic profile of the Black immigrant population in the United States, touching on issues that have to do with their migration patterns, their educational profile, and I'll talk a little bit about their children and the families in which these children live. So how did Black immigration to the United States start? Well, we all know that we have, for us to answer that question, we have to go back to the period of slavery. Right? So direct migration from Africa to the United States was a major part of that dynamic. And during the period of slavery, at least especially between 1519 to 1867, slightly under 400,000 Africans came to the United States directly. But around that same period, we also had some slave migration to the United States from the Caribbean. So you had African slaves who were taken to the Caribbean for seasoning before bringing them to the United States. That is perhaps the first flow of Caribbean, Black Caribbean immigration to the United States. With the end of slavery, all these migration flows actually ended. What we now have is a resurrection of those flows, at least since 1965, when we had the immigration reforms. Since that time, the Black immigrant population of the United States has increased by more than 1,000%. Some studies even argue that since 1965, more Black immigrants have arrived in the United States than the total number of slaves that arrived in the United States during the period of slavery. That growth has carried over into the population of children in Black immigrant families. So in the last two decades, for example, the number of children in immigrant families has increased by over 100%, but the growth in the children of Black immigrants has been much higher than that particular overall growth among immigrants. And this graph kind of like presents a pictorial representation of what I'm saying, showing a massive increase since 1960 of the total number of Black immigrants in the United States. And this next graph also shows some of the growth patterns that compares Black immigrants, children in Black immigrant families, with all Black children, regardless of whether they're immigrant or not, and all children of in immigrant families. So clearly what we see here is that in the last decade, in the previous century, and in the last in the first decade of the century, we see that the growth rate has been higher among Black children in immigrant families compared to all African-American children and compared to all children in immigrant families. So how diverse are these immigration flows? Well, clearly, if you look at Black immigrants, they differ in terms of their ethnic origins or their regions of origins. The most important sending region is the Caribbean. Black children of immigrants, actually about half of them have parents from the Caribbean. Another third of them have parents from Africa, and about 14% have parents from places like South America, even Europe, and other parts of the world. But even within these broad groups, African and Caribbean, populations, you still have additional dimensions of diversity. So among the Caribbean immigrant population, for example, Asians tend to dominate in terms of the origins of parents of these children, followed by Jamaicans and immigrants from Trinidad and Tobago, while among Africans, Nigerians clearly dominate, and they're followed by Ethiopians and immigrants from Somalia. So as Michael was saying, one of the startling findings in this volume has to do with the educational profile of black immigrants. So this particular slide captures the two extremes of educational attainment, though people with less than high school education and those with a four-year degree or professional degree. I'm talking about people who have a bachelor's, master's, or a PhD. And the clear thing that stands out in this slide is that Africans, right, in particular, have higher levels of educational attainment. You see that in the orange bar, compared to U.S. natives, all U.S. natives combined, and compared to all immigrants combined. And also in terms of though Africans who have limited levels of schooling, they still do much better compared to other immigrant groups. They're almost at the same level with U.S. natives. So let's talk a little bit about their families. What we found about the type of families that these children live in depends on who you're comparing them with, right? So if you compare black children of immigrants with African Americans, what you find is that black children of immigrants are less likely to live in single parent families compared to African American children. If the comparison group changes, and includes Asian or white immigrants, you see that black children of immigrants are more likely to live in single parent families than these other immigrant groups. This has very, very important implications for the children of black immigrants. Among them is the fact that because they are more likely to live in such families, they are also more likely to face the usual vulnerabilities associated with living in single-parent family contexts, such as, you know, poverty, low levels of educational attainment, at least in comparison with white and Asian immigrant groups. When you look at the major groups within the black immigrant population, Africans and Caribbeans, what we see in terms of family structure is that Africans are less likely to live in single-parent families than immigrants from the Caribbean. Another dimension of the family dynamics has to do with extended family patterns, right? And what we see in terms of children in immigrant families that have extended family members is that, you know, the highest prevalence of such occurrence occurs among is found among Caribbean black immigrants, right? And they're almost at the same level with Asians, but clearly much more than black Africans and all black immigrants combined. Extended families, again, among black immigrants in general, are much more prevalent than they are among U.S. natives. These families serve an instrumental purpose, right? So they help family members who might be trying to get on their feet, who might be in economic need, for short durations of time to actually help them get back on their feet. And again, one of the reasons why we believe Caribbean immigrants are much more likely to live in extended families is because they have been in the United States for a longer period, right? And if you've been here longer, you're much more likely to qualify for family reunification and provisions, right? And also another explanation is likely due to the fact that they're closer to the United States compared to Africa. And if you're closer, it's very possible that your migration costs might be lower. Okay, we do find, in terms of poverty, we do find that children of black immigrants are much more likely to live in poverty than children of white and Asian immigrants. I'll talk about a Hispanic group very shortly. All right, so this graph clearly shows that if you look at official poverty lines, right, the blue bars, the children of black immigrants clearly are much more likely to live in poverty. If you look at families that are slightly above poverty lines, but basically, they are low-income families. Children of black immigrants are also more likely to live in such families. The Hispanic figures kind of suggest that Hispanics are much more likely to live in poverty than black immigrants. However, if you decompose the Hispanic figures to look at black Hispanics from places like the Dominican Republic and white Hispanics from places like Cuba, you still see a black immigrant disadvantage, so that black Hispanics are much more likely to live in poverty than their white Hispanic counterparts. So this black immigrant poverty disadvantage is kind of surprising and concerning because it is counterintuitive. It's not what you would expect given their high levels of education, and it's not what you would expect when you look at their labor force participation rates. They're much more likely to participate in the labor force than U.S. natives. And it's also concerning because it has serious implications for the development of children. What we know from the available research is that children who are exposed to poverty in early childhood are much more likely to encounter problems in terms of their educational development, their psychological and social development, much later in life. So what is my take-home message? The take-home message is as follows. First of all, black immigration to the United States has increased significantly, and that increase has basically implications for the welfare of their families. We also see, at least in the short summary, that black immigrant families encounter severe socioeconomic constraints relative to non-black immigrant families. But we also see important similarities and differences between the major groups. Right? So Africans and Caribbeans are similar in one sense because they are much more likely to live in poverty than U.S. natives. But these two major groups are also different in another dimension. If you look at indicators such as parental citizenship status, Caribbean immigrants are much more likely to have parents who are U.S. citizens than African immigrants. And I think these similarities and differences are very, very important dimensions of the demographic profile of children in black immigrant families. Thank you.
Excellent. Would you just, for those of us who are not sociologists, define an extended family?
Good. An extended family, a simple definition, is basically what we refer to an extended family as a family that's not a nuclear family. A nuclear family is just the mother, the father, and the two kids. When you have additional members such as your grandmother, your cousins, wife, etc., that becomes an extended family.
Okay, perfect.
Thank you.
Excellent. Randy?
Sure. Well, I'd like to start just by thanking Kevin and Dylan for joining us today and thanking them and the other chapter authors. I think there's a series of really excellent detailed chapters on a variety of topics, and that really, really highlight the diversity of the immigrant population. And so what I'm going to talk about to start out with is the diversity of children of black immigrants, touching on some of the same points that Kevin mentioned. And there's a diversity, this means that there's a diversity of risk and protective factors for children's development. It's related to the variety of citizenship and legal statuses that immigrant parents have, related to a variety of levels of formal education, socioeconomic status, and I think very importantly, English language ability. In general, I think you can say that black immigrants have strong protective factors as parents, particularly those from Africa. But when you start disaggregating into smaller groups, there are concerns about, I think, two groups in particular that are raised in the book. The first is the non-English-speaking Caribbean populations, the largest being from the Dominican Republic and especially Haiti, and then a series of smaller African refugee populations, for example, refugee parents and families from the Sudan and Somalia. And this diversity makes generalizations difficult. That said, I'm going to go through a few generalizations and talk about some exceptions. Overall, in terms of protective factors for child development, a couple of chapters talk about birth outcomes. That is, the level of low birth weight and other birth complications. And here, children with black immigrant mothers do fare better than children with U.S.-born black mothers, but not as well as children with Latino and Asian immigrant mothers. And so this generalization that children of birth of immigrants have better birth outcomes applies somewhat to the black immigrant population, but not as heavily as you see in the literature overall. On the other hand, the evidence that we have in a couple of the chapters suggests that the decline in health status after birth, in part due to poverty and discrimination and other factors, is not as steep for children in black immigrant families as it is, say, for children in Latino families. Some other protective factors. Generally, most black immigrant parents are proficient in English. They have high levels of education, as Kevin mentioned, particularly African parents. And they have relatively high access to health care and public benefits in this country, which is not a given for immigrant families. This is in part due to the fact that very few of them are unauthorized or illegal immigrants, that much more of them are legal immigrants. Some come in as refugees, and with refugee status, they have very good access initially when they arrive. And the residential concentration of black immigrant families is much higher along the East Coast and in some other major cities and places like California that tend to have a better, more open social safety net for immigrants and in general than other immigrant groups. Also, there's very high participation in early education and formal child care settings such as Head Start, pre-K among black immigrants' children than among other immigrants' children. And this should, and in fact, it's as high as almost any group in some of the national data that are presented in the book. This should mean, if these are high-quality programs, that these children are very well prepared for school, or relatively well prepared for school. But there's a counterexample. There's a chapter on Ghanaian immigrants who, in many cases, aren't allowed to bring family members in. They don't have the extended families, as Kevin mentioned, so they don't have grandparents and other relatives to help care for their children while they're working. And for those who can't afford child care in the U.S., one option that they frequently take is to send the children back to Ghana to be raised with other relatives. So some general risk factors for children in black immigrant families. As Kevin mentioned, I think the single parenthood rate that's high among Caribbean families is important because it stands out versus what we see generally for children in immigrant families. But again, that is mitigated for Caribbean families by a larger presence of other family members in these extended families. Discrimination in the labor market and lack of credentialing is a big issue, and elsewhere MPI has written on this. This means that despite the high employment rates of black immigrant parents and their relatively high educational attainment, they're not doing jobs commensurate with their skills. They're underemployed, and this is associated with the relatively high rate of poverty that Kevin mentioned. Related to that as well, because of low socioeconomic status and concentration in large cities, particularly on the East Coast, housing burdens are very high for black children and immigrant families. They're less likely to live in owned homes. They're more likely to live in crowded housing than many other groups of children. And then finally, one indicator that is again related with socioeconomic status, this brought up in one of the chapters as a concern, is a relatively high rate of childhood overweight and obesity. And this is similar to what we see in the general black child and Latino child populations. So now just aggregating again the two higher risk groups that I mentioned. In particular, children of African refugees often have very low levels of parental education, and sometimes even basic literacy is lacking. Limited English skills, and in fact many times the African refugee population speak very rare and unusual languages that are very hard to support. Refugee experiences, that includes trauma in the home country as well as often extended stays in refugee camps, and sometimes limited experience with urban, if you will, Western world because of a rural setting. When you look at the larger group of Haitian and Dominican immigrants, you also see a low parental education here, limited English skills. One issue that comes up with children in these families as they come into the schools in the U.S. is interrupted formal education, because the school years get interrupted by a number of things, natural disasters, in the case of Haiti, civil disruptions, and of course these disruptions can have effects on families and children overall. So what do these risk and protective factors mean for children during the early years? And I'm just going to talk about a little bit about cognitive development and in particular the skills that children have as they're entering kindergarten. And the focus in a couple of chapters is on reading. Of course, having reading or pre-reading skills, being ready to learn to read, is going to be a very important indicator of children's future progress in school. And here we don't have clear findings. The findings vary according to whether or not it's national data looked at or case studies. We have case studies in Florida, Palm Beach County, as Michael mentioned, in New York City. They're not consistent among the chapters, and they're not consistent among the different groups studied. Generally, the findings show the reading pre-reading skills of children of black immigrants fall in the middle, somewhere between white and Asian children of immigrants who do better, and white and children, Asian children overall, and Latino children and children of black natives. They fare consistently better than Latino children of immigrants on these cognitive development measures. There's an interesting chapter with a comparison to the United Kingdom. And what's interesting about the comparison is that in terms of preparation for school, children of black immigrants fall in a similar stratum there. They do a little worse than most of the other groups, but they do substantially better than children of South Asian immigrants. That's children with parents born in India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, who in the United Kingdom tend to be the largest low socioeconomic status group. And for those of us who are data geeks, there are regression models in the book. These models suggest, not surprisingly, much of the lower scores on these reading tests are affected by parental education, employment, parenting practices, and early formal child care participation. Once these factors are controlled, the children of black immigrants and the overall U.S. child population or the population of study in a particular area tend to do similarly. There's an interpretation of some of the evidence is that there's migrant selectivity that may be favoring children of black immigrants once the poverty and these other factors are accounted for. The selectivity we demographers or sociologists think of is a form, it's about motivation. It's about the fact that parents have to work hard to get to the United States, particularly if they travel a long distance, which is the case from Africa. They often have a good work ethic, which is related to strong employment rates and a strong belief in children and their education. And again, this selectivity tends to be very high for African families, but it's high in general for immigrant parents. It's something we see across the literature. Where that selectivity may not come into play is with what we would call involuntary migrants, the refugees. The refugees are not moving by choice. And some broader groups of people coming from the Caribbean and Haiti in particular in recent years may fit a broader refugee definition. So given all this, what are some of the recommendations that we might have for future research on this and similar populations? First is to focus more so, we do some in the book, but continue to focus on specific origin groups rather than children of black immigrants overall, again, because it's hard to make the generalizations. This will be hard to do at the national level, as we and the authors found, because of the problem of small groups in data sets with small sample sizes. So it probably means more case studies are warranted. In particular, we would recommend case studies that focus on children in refugee families, owing to their special circumstances, not just before but after U.S. resettlement and some of the difficulties that their families may have been having longer term in the U.S. Focusing geographically, as is done with the Palm Beach and Miami-Dade and other studies in the book, conducting analysis of child well-being and preschool age development at the local level. And finally, we think it's warranted to explore the quality of early education programs and the impact that these early education programs have on education for children. A lot has been written with regard to children of Latino immigrants, but not much with regard to children of black immigrants and other smaller populations. So thank you very much.
Excellent job, Randy. Thank you. Dylan?
Yeah, thanks. I'm really delighted to be here and to have been able to participate in this initiative. And I learned a lot from the other chapters in the book. So I'm going to talk a little more about the academic achievement of black immigrants, and I'm going to start with a brief definition of a phrase known as the immigrant paradox, which Randy mentioned a little bit in his talk. And it's basically a phrase that's been applied to a set of observations about immigrants today generally. And it goes something like this. Immigrant children tend to arrive with many risk factors, such as poverty, low rates of parental education, limited English proficiency, and then minority status, which increases their risk of discrimination and racism. And so these are characteristics that usually get in the way of high rates of academic achievement and well-being. At the same time, they often show better health, developmental, behavioral, and educational outcomes than native-born who have these same background characteristics, that is, who are also poor and also from underrepresented minority groups. And so this is a very simple quantitative demonstration of the paradox using the Miami-Dade data that Megan Hatch and I used for our chapter in the volume. Here you see the reading percentile scores for Miami-Dade third graders. This is in 2008. So the average native-born in the Miami-Dade third grade population is at the 49th percentile on this nationally normed test. So this is relative to students across the nation. And the average foreign-born is at the 45th percentile. So the native-born are scoring higher by about 4 percentage points, which is what you might expect given all the advantages that native-born children should have in the school system. But now look what happens when I restrict the sample to white, students who are not poor and fully English proficient. Okay, so I'm narrowing the sample a bit to students who have the same background characteristics. And now here I'm seeing native-born are actually scoring lower by about 2 percentage points. Okay, so this is a very simple explanation of what we're observing, but the point being that when you compare the average immigrant student to the average native-born, who is disproportionately white, not poor, fully English proficient from highly educated home, the immigrant will underperform. But when you compare immigrants to other native-born who have similar background characteristics, oftentimes we see immigrants outperforming on many educational outcomes and other behavioral and health outcomes. So, and Randy mentioned some explanations for this, one being that immigration is a highly selective process. So immigrants are not a random draw of all residents of their sending nations, and they may be positively selected on many traits that benefit their children. They're generally healthier, have healthier behaviors, higher educational aspirations than some in the native-born population, strong work ethics, strong rates of family stability, heavy reliance on co-ethnic community members, and Kevin also mentioned the benefits of extended family members. And then in some research, we've learned about maybe a stronger ability to cope with discrimination and racism that they face. So these are all things that we have documented in the qualitative literature and some surveys of immigrant populations. If we were to able to successfully measure and capture all of these in our data sets and then add them as controls to what the examples I just showed you, perhaps we would see no immigrant paradox. That is, when you compare immigrants and native-born who are all similar on these traits, they end up looking the same in terms of their outcomes. There are also still a lot of questions in the paradox literature. So we don't necessarily observe a paradox in every single immigrant from every sending nation. And relevant to this volume, we don't have a lot of research on the black immigrant population for the reasons outlined by both Kevin and Randy, that because they represent a smaller share of the overall immigrant population, when you gather data at the national level, black immigrant students tend to represent in fairly small numbers, okay? Save for we have many good ethnographic descriptions like the pioneering work of Mary Waters on Caribbean immigrants in New York City, which again does not focus on this young age group. And there are reasons that you might expect differences in the black immigrant population than what we see in the Hispanic and Asian immigrant population, because the rates of exposure to English are so much higher in the black immigrant population. For example, in the Miami-Dade data, about a third of the black immigrant children live in homes where English is the primary language spoken, compared to 1% of the Hispanic immigrant children. And that gap is even larger when you look at New York City, which has a much higher share of black immigrants from English-speaking nations, where something like 70% of the children, black immigrant children in homes where English is spoken, compared to 5%, I think, of the Hispanic immigrants in New York City. And I mention New York City not only because it's a major host city for many black immigrants, but also because the other chapter in the volume on the academic achievement of black immigrants is by scholars from New York City using New York City data. So it's a really important contribution. So on the one hand, we would expect that having exposure to English would be very beneficial to immigrant children, right? Their parents can communicate better with the school and the teachers, help them with their homework. For obvious reasons, that's a strength. On the other hand, in some ways, perhaps having greater exposure to English could make those families a little more assimilated to the native-born culture and maybe less able to hold on to some of those traits I just listed previously that are in some ways unique or disproportionate in the immigrant population. So in the chapter that I did with Megan Hatch, we used data from Miami-Dade public schools on 3rd through 8th grade students in the years 2003 to 2008 to do the following two things. First, we compare the reading achievement of black immigrant students to black native-born students, and we do this both without controlling for any background characteristics and then with controls for background characteristics, such as poverty, disability status, and so on. And then we look within the black immigrant population to compare the reading achievement of black immigrants who live in homes where English is not the primary language spoken, and of course most of them are from Haiti, and compare them to the students who are in homes where English is the primary language spoken, about 50% of whom are from Jamaica, followed by large numbers from the British Virgin Islands and other West Indian nations. And here's basically what we find. So the black immigrant students earn the lowest test scores of all students in the district, lower even than black native-born students. Okay? But when we compare native-born black students with similar backgrounds to black immigrants, so in the same comparisons I showed you earlier, restricting to black students, for example, who are fully English proficient and not poor, so using that set of controls, black immigrants score about the same in the third grade, but they hold steady over time, while the black native-born reading achievement declines, such that by the fourth grade, black immigrant students are outperforming black native-born students with similar backgrounds, and that gap grows, continues to grow by the eighth grade. Okay? So this is consistent with the paradox story that we've read about in the larger literature, which again concentrates primarily on Hispanic and Asian immigrants. So we're seeing a paradox within the black immigrant population as well. And then finally, among black immigrants, we see those in English-speaking homes scoring much higher than those in non-English-speaking homes in the third grade. But over time, their trajectories are very different. The non-English-speaking black immigrant children tend to have a steep and steady upward growth in their reading achievement, while the English-at-home black immigrant children have a steady decline, to the point where they actually cross lines. So by the sixth grade, they're performing about the same, and by the eighth grade, you see the black children from predominantly non-English-speaking homes, the Haitians, outperforming in this cohort of students, those who came from English backgrounds. And there's a number of possible stories here. One is that the immigrant children in the non-English-speaking homes could actually be more positively selected on some of those traits I listed earlier than those in English-speaking families. Or it could be that over time, that group is better able to hold on to those positive attributes than the English-speaking families that perhaps are more assimilated in some way. And another possibility still is that the non-English at home black children are better served by the school system in some way, or perhaps learning English for the first time in the United States is somehow more beneficial to long-term academic English proficiency than arriving with some pre-learned set of version of English. So this is a one-shot study in one city with one cohort of students. So obviously there's still a lot to explore in this literature. So my two takeaways. I mean, my reading of the research literature on immigrant children is that, much of which is supported by this volume, in fact. They are at risk of academic failure because they are disproportionately poor English language learners and from underrepresented minority groups. Okay, so if we want to raise the achievement of immigrant children, we should continue to concentrate policies on removing barriers for those at-risk groups. So, for example, English language learner status is a huge barrier in school. We need to continue to test and explore better ways to teach English to our children fully and rapidly. Poverty is a huge barrier to achievement. We need to find more ways to compensate in the school system. So, for example, increasing access to high-quality early childcare, which is something that Randy mentioned. But the second takeaway is that being an immigrant in and of itself is actually not a risk factor. It's a protective factor. There are many, many strengths in the immigrant community that serve the children very well. And this is as true in the black immigrant community as it is in the Asian and Hispanic immigrant communities, I think is what we've learned here. And here's where we have much less policy experience. But if we could explore ways to promote and somehow expand, cultivate, replicate those strengths in the school system, not only would we continue to raise the achievement of immigrant children, but perhaps we could have effects also on native-born children. Thanks.
Excellent. Before we go to the next two speakers, what I thought I would do was ask if anybody has any explanatory questions they would like to ask of these three.
among Caribbean black immigrants. I noticed in the chapter you mentioned that their median earnings are very high, almost comparable with the entire U.S. population, but then you also spoke about the very high rates of living in poverty, and I wondered if you're seeing a big split there.
Well, thank you very much. Well, with Caribbean immigrants, even as with African immigrants, because economic outcomes are clearly affected by levels of human capital and English language proficiency, you do see some bifurcation such that those groups that have much more English proficient, such as the people from the Caribbean, from Trinidad and Tobago and Jamaica, would have higher levels of income, while immigrants from places like Haiti, right, that don't speak English as well, have lower levels of income. So there clearly is some bifurcation there.
Paul Donnelly, I work with Morrison Public Affairs Group. I'm not sure what is and is not an explanatory question, so if this is the wrong one to ask, I apologize. But I wonder to what extent the differences we're seeing have to do with how people got here. In other words, refugees obviously start lower and the ladder is steeper. Family-based immigrants tend to have families, and employment-based immigrants tend to have skills.
I do think as an overall sort of framing question for the volume, that's an important one. And certainly the comparison with Latino immigrants as being the largest socioeconomically disadvantaged group among immigrant families. There's a high level of lack of legal status in that group, and there is not, in general, in the black immigrant population. There are some variations. There are some Caribbean immigrants who do lack legal status, and that's a partial explanation for the bifurcation you do tend to see. In fact, in some site work we did recently, we were trying to find out about how well Haitian students were doing in schools in Palm Beach County in Florida and in New York City. And in both cases, we were getting answers all over the map. You're getting the best and the brightest that fled the earthquake, but you're also getting people who are very, very poor and coming with nothing. So I think that's a partial answer to that. The refugee side, of course, that's an important factor because of the conditions that people are fleeing, and that population's very diverse too. But within the black immigrant population, we have seen some particularly disadvantaged refugee groups. And then the diversity program, which we didn't talk a lot about here, kind of comes in the middle. People have to have at least a high school degree, but not necessarily more than that. And they are randomly selected from a pool. They don't have family members here or a particular job. So that population is drawing, I think, a wide variety as well.
Okay. Hi, Bob Barron, Citizenship Immigration. Did you have a chance in your studies to look at the level of work or the incidence of parental the labor force, as it compared to the treatment of the children, and if there was less or more discrimination based upon, you know, parental jobs or based upon the way they were being employed?
I don't know if you have, but I think the second part of that, no, not in this volume, but for parental work, certainly it is very high among Caribbean mothers. In part because so many are single parents, but also in general, a lot of two-parent working families, and higher than you would see for most other immigrant groups. But the level of maternal work is lower for African families that tend to be more likely to be two-parent and maybe more traditional sort of father employed, mother stay at home. In general, the paternal rates of employment are very high in the African immigrant population. When I sort of alluded to discrimination, there is a previous study that was done at Migration Policy Institute a few years ago that showed that African immigrants, along with Latino immigrants, don't get as much returned education, the skill levels of their jobs, especially when they first arrive in the U.S.
Yes, that's exactly it, underemployment. It's not an issue of employment, it's an issue of underemployment, and it goes to the point that Kevin made, that this is a highly, particularly the African population is highly educated, but they're not getting the return on their education that they would otherwise get. And we think that part of that is credential recognition, a simple translation of credentials. Some component part of that may be discrimination in the labor market. This is getting too interesting, so I'm going to cut it off. And turn instead to Jerry James, who gives a few. So Randy and Dylan and I are, and Kevin are eager to hear his take on the body and on the issue writ large.
Okay, thank you. Well, first, I'd like to thank the editors, Randy and Michael, and Kevin and Dylan and the other authors for giving us this highly informative and much needed book. And what I want to do in my few minutes of remarks is to attempt to express some the thoughts that I was having as I was going through the book. That is what the sort of overriding thoughts I was having as I went through various kinds of statistics and findings and things like that, rather than the individual things themselves. And that really fell into two questions. Under the general rubric, what does it mean? And I want to just confine my remarks to what does it mean for the present, what is it, at least from the way I was thinking as I read. And then secondly, where are we going? What are the implications for the future? And I'm going to put that within the context, of course, since it was my brain that was doing this thinking within its own experiential camp. As has been given to us in the previous remarks, the first thing one might want to think about with respect to what's covered here is, under one word, diversity. Right? But this is a hugely diverse population in terms of geographic origins, language, education of parents, ethnicities. That diversity, of course, leads to diverse needs, which is one way of covering two words that cover much of what was said by Kevin and Dylan. And those diverse needs then lead me to thinking, if we're thinking in terms of the present, then to really be present-oriented, it took my thoughts to our current political problem, our so-called fiscal cliff, and made me think, well, if we've got these diverse needs in this population, which is just simply exemplifying the diversity of needs in our entire U.S. population, what is this idea about the fiscal cliff and the underlying huge gap about what are the pressing priorities for the nation that this the debate that's going on, or so-called meeting negotiations. What do they mean? Well, they mean one thing. There are too few resources that are flowing to the most disadvantaged children. And much of that's documented in this book, not simply for young children of black immigrants, but as Randy has said, and Michael said in his earlier comments as well, because of the comparative framework being used also to large numbers of other populations in the United States. But what I want to suggest is that this takes us back to this political gap. It's due largely to a lack of a feeling of shared community, that we are, in fact, one people. What do I mean by that? Well, sort of put it under the rubric of what the sociologists call master identity. There are too many master identities in the United States population. Unlike, say, some 40-some years ago when I was sharing a foxhole with a young white boy the same age as I was, but he was from Mississippi, we had one master identity. We were Americans, and that's all that really mattered that night as we watched a firefight going on out in the jungle. But go back home, he's a white boy from Mississippi, and it's 1967, and I'm a black boy from Illinois, and we probably took on very different other kinds of identities, and the master identity may well have been different for him. I've always thought of myself as an American first. What I want to suggest is that political problem, that lack of this shared master identity, that we are a community of one people, leads to much of our political debate over domestic policy issues. And somewhat paradoxically, that great heterogeneity, that is, larger numbers of ethnicities, races, and groups scattered throughout the population in various numerical quantities, may engender a stronger sense of a national community than the simple duality that frames most of American history, what I have elsewhere called the black-white paradigm, and because of its intense polarization. Now, a lot of this depends on the resilience of what I have also called the symbiotic relationship between the American dream and that black-white paradigm, which briefly put is simply that this American dream is that success depends only on hard work and talent, and the black-white paradigm upholds the power of that dream because it in effect says that the only group that has apparently been an exception to that rule, black Americans, are really not an exception because their failures have been their own fault. Now, whether those two things can continue over the next, let's say, 50 years to drive much of American ideology and domestic policies is going to depend on what the poor population looks like as the next few decades of American history unfold. Are they going to continue to be largely or very disproportionately made up of people we'll call African Americans? No, don't think so. Already, in fact, that population is in equal numbers between Hispanic and African American peoples, and other groups are growing larger as well. So, what this leads to, this great diversity of immigration that we have been witnessing for the past several decades is, and of course, the election that we just saw, as all the political commentators will tell us, but as any of us who thought about this much at all during the last decade at least, would have been able to say, political restructuring. Now, there's no time, and it's not necessary that I talk about the precise nature of this political restructuring, but what I in fact see is that in whatever various way it goes, there will be empowerment among those populations who I referred to earlier as being having greater needs and greater needs of for resources devoted to children. That's what I think the much larger heterogeneity in the population and in the polity is going to lead to over the near future. And that, in and of itself, is going to bring about great change. So, this shared sense of community that I began with, I think will, after a current period, which has to work itself out where we have less of a shared feeling of community, but at some point, huge numbers of immigration will stop. There'll be a restructuring of the society and a sort of what one might call a new demographic equilibrium. What it's going to look like is up to anybody's guess. That sort of takes me back to thinking, certainly, well, just as an example, my sister is a grandmother of seven, none of which have two African-American parents, nor a parent of the same ethnicity on the other side. So her grandchildren just simply kind of represent what I think is where we're kind of going. I'm going to close at that point. I just wanted to bring out these thoughts as precisely what it was that reading through this volume opened to my eyes and where my thoughts were led. Thank you.
Well, I hope you're right about the prospect of increased resources for children down the road. I have a feeling, at least for the short term, my aging baby boom generation is going to suck a lot of those, a lot of those up. But anyway, let's talk about even a shorter term. Let's talk about the next 4 years.
I'm making no promises about the next 4 years. I was going to say, can I just say amen? Professor Jane said, or just take the next 10 minutes to repeat exactly what you said, so we hear it twice, because it was very profound and helpful, and also echo some of the things that I was planning to raise about diversity, diverse needs, and implications. But since I have some prepared remarks here, I think I'll go ahead and share them. So first of all, I want to thank Michael and Randy and the Migration Policy Institute for hosting today's gathering and inviting me to be part of this event. It's very personal for me. Randy Capps and Michael Fix are two of the colleagues in my professional life that have nurtured my own scholarship and who I have learned among the most from and to whom I have an abiding and now growing debt. So I also want to thank all of the authors for your contributions for this timely compendium on the young children of black immigrants in the U.S. And also a special shout out to the Foundation for Child Development, and most notably its past president, Ruby Takanishi, for supporting the work. I know Ruby well. Ruby has nurtured some of my own work over the years, and she truly had a knack and has a knack of seeing and supporting the next important directions for research and advocacy, especially as it concerned children of immigrants. So, big area of concern for mine as well. So I, again, I'm also going to express some thoughts that occurred to me as I was reading this, and much of this, you know, is my own, you know, experiential reflections, but also build a little bit on similar things to what Professor Jane said, and talk a little bit about what I think some of the implications might be for policy consideration and for future research. So first, I think, is the diversity issue. Point out just how reading this book, it occurs to one over and over again just how misleading the dominant contemporary American picture of the immigrant population is, and maybe how small our appreciation for what is arguably a vibrant and renewing force for the nation. Now, that's a bit of hyperbole, so let me say what I think I mean. As probably everyone in the room knows full well, the largest source of immigration in the large recent wave and a major driving force in the changing demographics of who America's children are over the last 30 years has been Mexican immigration. This is now the dominant picture that exists in the American mind, and the last I looked, which is a little while ago, they do account for about 40% of the foreign-born population and or the proportion of children of immigrants. So we have all lived through, witnessed what could be called the Mexican immigration wave, which peaked in the 1990s and has been for us what the Irish immigration wave was for the 1840s, the German wave was for the 1850s, the Italian wave was for the 1880s, and the Jewish and other Eastern Europeans wave was for the turn of the last century. A fundamental reshaping based on a large boom. But what this book represents, what Kevin's presentation as well as the chapters by the folks here at MPI and Don Hernandez is the demographic portrait is what frequently gets lost in the conversations about immigration and what research like this is important, why research like this is important. That is to broaden the lens to show the other 60%, of whom, according to the recent numbers, black immigrants, particularly from Africa and the Caribbean, have represented a growing and growing share, or now represent 1 in 6 of that segment, the other 60%, or 9% of all immigrants. According to the data in this volume, what many may have missed during the post-1980 wave was that the number of black immigrants has increased fourfold in just the last 30 years. And it's the other 60% that really may be like no other. The Mexican immigration wave may resemble some aspects of prior immigration waves, but this other 60% really is like nothing else the country may have experienced. So that talks to the narrowness of our vision and the smallness of our discourse. We don't see how incredibly and uniquely diverse the contemporary U.S. immigrant population and their children are in U.S. historical and in global terms. Last time I looked carefully at the data on children of immigrants, a year or two ago, what strikes you is the incredible distribution of the origins of the other 60%. If I recall, after the large Mexican share, there are about a dozen countries of origin who contribute between 2 and 5% of the parents of children of immigrants. Some of them are also the countries in the Caribbean. And another dozen or so, they contribute more than 1%, between 1 and 2%. And they are fairly evenly distributed across the continents and corners of the world. They're, I mean, you know, 10% come from Africa and the Caribbean. Another 10% come from the Middle East and South Asia. Another 10% comes from East Asia. Another 10% comes from Europe. Another 15% comes from South America. Another 15% from Central America. I mean, that is historic in its diversity. While we have just about always been a nation of immigrants, or the nation of immigrants, I don't think we or any other nation has ever seen as diverse and possibly transformative a wave as this recent one. The changing of who our children are has never occurred so rapidly and so dramatically as what we might be seeing today. And when you talk, I mean, you're talking about just within, mixed race families. But I think there is no real, I mean, I echo the point you make, there is no real way to sort of really picture what the country looks like 25 years from now. And that is, in many ways, exciting. And so, at least my reading of the trends in demographic breakdown from within regions like black migrants from Africa and the Caribbean that we show here is the growing diversity in countries of origin. So even within the African migration, the tables in the that were in the chapter that Randy, Kristen, and Michael showed, that decade by decade, there's a greater contribution from more sources. Similarly for the Caribbean, there's a greater contribution from more sources that are contributing to the U.S. So the question then is, well, is that a good thing? And from my perspective, it certainly is, and it is. It's not a predictable thing. It's not something that we can really say what that bodes for the future. But it provides an amazing, vibrant aspect of what the U.S. is. I'll add a couple of other things. I'm sure that'll lead to some discussion. But the really detailed demographic portrait, and this is a very detailed demographic portrait, this volume highlights for me that I think are important to keep in mind when we start to consider policies important to immigrant families and children and what their addition offers their communities and our country. Today's immigrants and their children are not only diverse in their countries of origin, which I just talked about, but in several other important ways that potentially shape and can benefit the country. And this is borne out in the research here on black immigrants from Caribbean and Africa, but also is true of many of the other immigrant groups that have been coming to the shores over the last 30 years. And some of those were brought up here, including the diversity in educational attainment, in family composition, in age distribution, the educational attainment of families. And I think, Kevin talked well about the educational attainment and the family composition. The other two I want to sort of bring up is the age distribution, because Michael just mentioned the baby boomers, who are on our minds a lot as we walk towards the cliff. and she decided whether to throw them over. No, I'm just joking. I didn't say that. So in addition to the work distribution levels, which are, again, remind you, are higher than for immigrants as a whole, as well as for African and Caribbean immigrants, are higher than the U.S. population, that adds to our national value, that adds to our gross national product. That is a buffer in a time when the employment population ratio in the country is shrinking and will continue to shrink. 60% of all immigrants, according to the data in this book, and 61% of black immigrants are between the ages of 25 and 54. Or in their prime working and their prime parenting ages. That's compared to, again, the data in this book, just 39% of the native-born population. This is the population that is contributing the most to our revenue side, and we need their arrival in supporting as an age range when the number of workers is relatively shallower. At a time when more prime working age folks are moving, and there's a growing population of native-born elderly. So these are real strengths for the country, both in terms of dealing with the current and prospective fiscal challenges, but also in terms of the nature and in a time of the last 5 years have seen relatively sharply declining birth rates, and this population has kept that from declining as fast as otherwise would. Now turning a little bit to my job in policy. That means I just went over 10 minutes, so I'm going to be quicker now. Time myself there. So HHS operates.
Better than the moderator.
I know. So also a few quick things. HHS operates several health and human services programs that frequently interact with immigrant families, and at times we may uniquely serve some of their needs. In particular, the Office of Refugee Resettlement, represented here by its director, the Office of Head Start, for whom there were some interesting findings are noted in this volume. So just like the broad diversity and many other immigrant characteristics just mentioned is the modes of entry, which somebody raised. The 25% of African immigrants in the U.S. had come here with refugee status, and that 3 out of 10, I think, in the book, of all refugees coming since 2000 come from the African continent. I think it would be important for HHS to study the long-term outcomes of the African refugee population. I would echo the point about case studies, but also just we need to know what happens, particularly to the children in these families, how their entering as refugees may or may not have the same advantages in terms of educational attainment and family ties as other African immigrants. I think breaking that down for the refugee versus the non-refugee, which I don't think I saw, would actually be helpful and might be something to do in the future. And to understand how they fare, especially as their short-term supports offered through the refugee assistance programs diminish, and including how will they be affected by ACA implementation and other things that our department has to focus on. And then probably another broad set is on the development and education of children. So in their earliest and developmentally most important years, this volume offered some encouraging news regarding children in Black immigrant families. They seem to have relatively broad access to service and benefits, such as health insurance coverage, nutritional assistance, and center-based child care, and especially Head Start, if I read the data right. Their service access is relatively better than for other groups of children of immigrants, and it would be good to further understand what contributes to that. There's a lot of hypotheses in the book about why they may have access, and some are based on their status, some are based on language, but it would be really good to understand this, some based on geography. And this broader-based access, probably coupled with other economic and social protective factors that were discussed, may account for the fact that one of the chapters by Daniel Crosby and Angel Dunbar showed that at kindergarten entry, there's little to no gap in early reading and math skills relative to native white children, which is while there's a substantial gap in measured early cognitive skills for U.S.-born African-American children and for both native and immigrant Latinos, that is present at 24 months and persists until kindergarten. So why kids go on these different tracks? In fact, what is really seen is that Black immigrant children also start at a gap at 24 months, but they, in part maybe because they have access to early childhood, actually do some catching up. And then focusing on a different data set, different sample, probably different measures, Dylan's and Megan Hatch's analysis of Florida school data indicated that by third grade, again, this is probably two different pictures, but a fairly large gap in reading has developed between foreign-born blacks and native-born whites, and at the start, at least, there's no gap between foreign-born blacks and native-born blacks. The gap grows between foreign-born blacks and native-born blacks, and it persists but doesn't grow between whites and foreign-born blacks. Understanding that would also be interesting. I mean, I do think that these are more likely just two different pictures of two different groups. One is a set of immigrant children as opposed to children of immigrants. Or there might be some need to reconcile the two pictures. In any case, I think what would be good to follow the Crosby and Dunbar ECLSB cohort or cohorts like that to see how those Black immigrant children are doing and whether their relative advantage they gained in early childhood experience persists as they move on. Or how are they faring in third grade before they sort of make it into, I mean, they're not the same kids, but they make it into Dylan's sample. I guess the last thing I would say is on the overall implications about early childhood and income integration, just how important this book shows early childhood development and early childhood development resources can be, how patchy it is in terms of how much it's offered to overall to anyone that we can see such wide variations in school readiness. Maybe especially important how programs like Head Start can be a real source of integration for children and families of immigrants in a way that is unique. Head Start is a two-generational program. It offers services to both parent and child. It occurs very early in the immigrant family lifespan in the U.S. It offers integration across two generations, and I think, you know, Head Start has always had a special role. It's good to see it in this volume because we know from the data that Head Start has been much more likely to serve Latino dual language learners than other early childhood programs, twice the rate than, let's say, other center-based childcare or even state pre-kindergarten programs. And what is it about Head Start? And that has changed the nature of Head Start, in part just because Head Start requires to adapt and serve the needs of families as they arrive. So integration, the last point I'll make is integration goes two ways. It's really bidirectional. It's the important difference between, quote, assimilation and integration, is that, yes, you remake us, but we also remake you. And that is a source of strength. I think that's a source of strength for Head Start. I think Head Start, there's more that can be done to adapt Head Start to meet the needs of today's population, which is very different from when Project Head Start started in 1965. These populations live in new parts of the country that didn't have Head Start before, and I think that these present important and necessary challenges. For that, I'm thankful to all of you for developing this body. Thanks.
AJ, we are now in your deck after those excellent comments. So let's open it up to questions, and they can be any kind of questions. They don't have to be explanatory questions. They can be polemical questions.
Myrtle Washington from Habitat Community in Northern Virginia. I want to go back to Randy. I was struck when you said that.
Well, let me go back a little more. I heard Camara Jones. I don't know if you're familiar with her. She does research at the CDC in Atlanta, and she studies racism and its effect on the health of the nation. And one of the things that she studied is the low birth weight as an effect of racism on black women in America. So I was struck by what you said of the low birth weight of immigrant families, some of them, and whether or not that low birth weight has something to do with the immigration, or is it something to do with they become a part of us, as AJ just said, they've become a part of us and taken on some of the things that this country represents, such as racism.
Okay, let me just start by saying that I am a demographer by training, so I understand some of the issues around low birth weight. That was not my chapter, so I may get in a little over my head on this, but I can hypothesize. Again, looking at the diversity of the population, I think one would expect there might be some similarities with the Caribbean population, both in terms of the history of the Caribbean countries and in terms of the higher rate of single parenthood among those immigrant populations, and that with the African immigrant population, it might be different. One of the things that we were not able to do for this, but there is some research, I think, that's going to be forthcoming out of University of Pennsylvania, I believe it is, and it's the head of the POP Center now there, and her name is escaping me.
Irma?
Yes. Irma Elo has been doing some research on this that disaggregates. And here it's another issue where I think it's important to disaggregate what those birth outcomes are for different immigrant groups. And so I think they're going to be different. That scenario is going to play out very differently. And it also would get to recency. Caribbean immigrant populations are more established. They've had more exposure to the racism in the U.S. than the African populations, which are more recent. So that's what I know are some questions, I think, for future research. But Irma Elo out of the University of Pennsylvania may have some preliminary answers to that.
One thing I will note is one of the findings in the health chapter by Tiffany Green showed very low levels of prenatal care in the first trimester among black immigrant mothers. Otherwise, the parental behaviors were very strong in terms of not smoking, not drinking, and and breastfeeding and the like, but there was that one more troubling finding. Next. Yes, you, please.
Hi, I'm Wendy Jeffries from the U.S. Branch of International Social Service. First of all, I want to thank everyone for their comments, and I'm going to build, my question builds a little bit on the comments made about the extended families and the diverse needs of immigrant, black immigrant children. In our work, we're seeing an increase in the number of black immigrant children who are becoming involved in the public child welfare agencies in the U.S., and I noticed in flipping through the book, I don't see any chapter on that, but I was wondering, A, if that had been explored by anyone on the panel or that you're aware of. And then also for the panel to speak to as well, based on your expertise and related experience, what are you sort of seeing as possible implications for black immigrant children when they become involved with the child welfare agencies, and more specifically during the permanency planning process and trying to figure out the best interests of children who are involved in the system in terms of engaging and finding family members in their children, their countries of origin? So that was a lot right there.
Well, we have a federal official who is...
federal official can say he doesn't know. what I can say is it's... You know, there's been broader questions, not necessarily the questions of children of immigrants from the African continent or from the Caribbean nations, around identifying how many children in the child welfare system have foreign-born parents or immigrants, which is really hard to get at, because one thing is it's not something that is part of the administrative data that is provided to the federal government, and which is something that we are trying to think through how we can change that. So, for example, you're required to submit information on race and ethnicity, but you could not be able to say of X percent, there is this proportionality in certainly in terms of race that exists in the child welfare system, but I wouldn't be able to tell you by the click of a button, oh, this is the number who had foreign-born parents versus U.S.-born parents. That's probably something, given the diversity and the nature of where children, what children's histories are in the U.S., that should be addressed, and we are looking into that. So I don't have a good answer for that. If there are people in the audience who know, or Randy might know, who have worked with particular states. So I would imagine that Florida, New York, there would be some, Illinois would be some states that might have some information. No, no one has any information.
Randy's rapidly becoming an expert.
You wouldn't have the data. I mean, I think the big issues, you know, there's two or three of them that you mentioned. There's less risk of actually family separation because of an immigration enforcement action, because the population mostly has legal status. There's also less opportunity for setting up international family reunification. To the extent that's been done in immigrant populations, it's been done primarily with Mexico and agreements with the Mexican consulate, and this is so. But there's also more geographic concentration of the population, so there might be consulates from some of the larger countries in some cities with significant populations that could be involved in that. I just think it's going to be harder with such a diverse population to address those kind of issues. But I really think it's a sort of case study approach to going to where the black immigrant family populations are and talking to the child welfare offices in a systematic way to figure out the prevalence and the issues is going to be the only way to get at that.
Here and then Joy next.
Hi, my name is Erica Madden. I'm with Catholic Charities and Legal Services. My question has to do with the different status groups that you talked about. You talked about refugees and family-based immigration, but you didn't really talk about undocumented African immigrants or Caribbean immigrants or asylees, people who come to the United States and seek asylum. So have you seen any difference between undocumented immigrants, asylees, and the educational attainment and health outcomes for their children?
I will just say, and then Randy can Kevin can maybe come in here. Two populations that have significant numbers of undocumented members or people without strong membership claims within the United States are the Dominicans and the Haitian populations. And those are both populations where we look at the numbers in the New York City schools. Those are both populations that have marginal membership claims. They have, you know, they've interrupted schooling in their native country, and a large, significant share of them are not English proficient. And in terms of their absolute test scores, they actually lag badly within those, within that school system, where, which is a generally underperforming school system. We didn't really carve out the undocumented population and identify the undocumented population and do separate analyses. But that's our, that would be my best intuitive response to your question. Randy, do you want to make any further?
Not that much. I do, well, the undocumented African American or black immigrants, because they're undocumented, it's very difficult to get information from them. There are some estimates about what we believe might be, you know, the proportions they represent. But I think one fact that needs to be pointed out, though, is that, you know, for many of these black immigrant populations, the pathways to undocumentation is quite are quite different from the pathways to undocumentation for Mexican immigrants. In other words, for an African immigrant to become undocumented, they become undocumented by first coming as legal immigrants, right? And then maybe overstaying their visas, right? While for, like, Mexican immigrants, a lot of them who are undocumented can come through, I mean, they start off as undocumented immigrants. That might have maybe some implications for levels of human capital, et cetera, because for you to even qualify to get a visa in the first place, you probably must be at least maybe middle-class status. So those are the speculations I can give. But unfortunately, we don't have data on the children of those immigrants. It would be very useful if we do.
I just want to say one thing, which is that we didn't really get into this in the book, but Fabien Doucet, who's one of the authors, has started to do some field work in New York on the shift in the reception of Haitian immigrant children in New York City public schools after the earthquake. Mm-hmm. And there's a concomitant shift in the legal status toward temporary mm-hmm. protected status. And I think it would be very interesting to think about. There's just been a change in the perception of Haitian immigrants that accompanied the earthquake. There may be a long-term shift there. I don't know. I mean, when you think of asylum seekers, that's a very large group that's traditionally been kind of quasi-undocumented, sometimes undocumented, sometimes not. There may be more stability in their legal status. It would be very interesting to do some sort of retrospective research on how that's changed in the Haitian community.
Joy?
Joy Payton, Center for Applied Linguistics and Alliance for the Advancement of Heritage Languages. Thank you so much for this wonderful panel. This was just fabulous. I just wanted to mention one thing that I also believe doesn't get talked about when thinking about immigrants and refugees, and actually I don't think it's been mentioned here. That is the heritage language, we call them heritage language, they communities and groups that have established and are running very strong educational and social programs, and I don't mean social service programs, I mean social connection programs for the students, the children, the students, the families who speak that language. Very long history in this country of German, of course, with Saturday school community-based programs. Very strong Chinese groups in this country, but Korean, Japanese, I could go on and on. But relevant to this conversation today is, for example, the French Heritage Language Program in New York City. And Dr. James, I want to talk to you and see if we can get you connected with them, who are working with African immigrants and Haitians and linking them up with opportunities related to being French. You are whoever you are, and you're learning English, and you're also French, giving them access to the lycée français, which only Europeans have had access to in the past, letting them do performances, linking them up with high-level officials in the embassy and other places as French people. This is giving them identity, opportunity, agency, education. And I'll just say something, And so I think we need to support them, connect with them, and work with them, and look beyond federal agencies and the public school system and say, hey, there's a whole other community out there. And you know, we're worried about going over the fiscal cliff. They've been over a cliff. They know what that's like. They know how to recreate themselves afterwards. So all I want to do is just say, let's work with those people.
Thank you. I went to a French school, and I'm not sure that's such a great idea.
You're not French.
Thank you so much for this wonderful information. My name is Julian Kiganda. I'm from African Diaspora for Change. One of the questions, actually piggybacking off of what she just said, did you look at cultural practices or value systems as it pertained to your research and how that impacted some of the outcomes?
Yes, I think we broadly have two sets of studies, and the cultural practices don't really appear in the sort of the major national data sets, and that's a major weakness of them. But when we started to get into some of the case studies, we look at that a little bit more. The best example of that, I think, is the Ghanaians and the child fostering. The example there is that the fostering, which is allowing the children to live with another relative besides the parent in another part of the country, is well established within Ghana, and that tradition lent itself to the international migration context with a well-established sort of level of trust and just a way of doing things that would allow those relatives in Ghana to be able to take those children in when the child care was unavailable in the U.S. So that would be the example of a cultural practice that was able to fill the gap in U.S. structure being the lack of affordable child care. So that's one example.
And it's an anthropological study, so it isn't as data dependent as many of the other chapters in the volume. Yes.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for this awesome presentation. I've learned so much from every researcher presented here today. I have a few comments, though. Number one, we were told so much about, for example, the education systems in schools, how it's faring for the black immigrants versus the black natives, and really about outcomes. If a population group is not doing as well as to be expected, which means that there's potential that the level of contributing to the nature of this country could be dwindled, what do you recommend to address this, to make sure every child living in the U.S., regardless of background, really get up to speed on obtaining education today? That's one thing.
Can we stop there? Because that's one pretty big thing.
But I'll be honest with you, though, I really feel as though, whether we have a cliff or not, we have the resources to do so. I am, from my voice, you know, I'm not from this country. I'm a from Trinidad. And I really believe, though, we all know that we have read it. Dr. Thomas, thank you for your articles on education. I cited you so much in my study I did recently. But everyone, I believe we want our children to get an education. So once again, too, how can we all work together? And I think we have to figure out a way. Here we are today, super researchers in this room today. If we tackle one issue, which is education, how can we really do it? We have a great Head Start program. We've learned what happened in Head Start. How can we make sure whatever knowledge our kids attain so early on, it continues throughout their lifespan?
Can I just spin that question just a tiny bit? I mean, it seems to me like the great revolution in education today is the Common Core, and the Common Core has an uncertain relationship to English language learning, which will be important for this population.
And you said it was the Common Core. What is that?
It's a set of standards that have been adopted by 48 states now, of learning standards that have been adopted by 48 states in all the major disciplines, so that you can know whether somebody in the 11th grade who took science in Nebraska knows the same thing as somebody who took science in the 11th grade in New York. It makes the system more predictable, and it imposes a whole set of performance obligations on the system in the way the No Child Left Behind Act intended to do, but because it left so much state variation, didn't didn't get us there. So
I think it was sort of the concept that should have came before No Child Left Behind, in a way. Is here's what we're expecting of all the students. These are the standards. Now let's start testing them and applying these standards and holding schools and students accountable. And I think because it hasn't been launched widespread, it's unclear what the impacts will be on all students and on English language learners in particular. So I guess I wouldn't put that forth as your solution to fixing the education system. I think there's a lot of good stuff going on. I guess if I were to profile what a lot of people in the research and policy community seem to be latching onto, is actually remedying a lot of the gaps that students have before they even get to kindergarten. Because those gaps tend to have a strong correlation with your gaps in the eighth grade. So if we can, the idea being if we can narrow them before they get to schools, assuming schools don't make it any worse, we could remedy a lot of the disparities. So for example, the high quality pre-K being one example of a major initiative.
And you know, what my worry here is that what we see is very high levels of use of early childhood education and childcare in this book among children of black immigrants. These are programs that are going to get hit pretty hard if we go off the fiscal cliff.
The way the K through 12 system.
Yeah.
I'm Diane Ford DeSalle from Bread for the World, and I just want to underscore the point that you just last made, not just the fiscal cliff situation here and now, but looking forward, one of Bread for the World's goals is to end hunger and poverty at home and abroad, both here in the United States and around the world by 2040. And I've had the privilege of being able to listen to other presentations that expand on what needs to be done in order to achieve that. The impact of global warming and its impact on food security and its impact on destabilization in different countries and different regions around the world is going to have a significant impact on this conversation. So it's going to be, that's one observation over time. The other observation is that the impact of funding, I've heard through your presentation that there are certain times and places within certain demographics where there's been a social safety net for a variety of different children at different times. WIC, SNAP, whether or not there's going to be funding for poverty-focused development assistance, all of that will have an impact on the research that you're doing over time. So I just wanted to lift those things up so that you'll have your eye cast to them as you continue to develop the research.
I am sorry to say this, but since we're being live streamed, we have to be disciplined and we have to end at 12:15. We'll take one question in the back and then we'll close.
Sorry, everybody. My name is Roger Carruth. I'm a PhD candidate at Howard University, specifically looking at issues around the Caribbean diaspora. I'm originally from St. Vincent. And I'm looking at the use of technology to kind of bridge some of these cultural gaps. If any of the people in the panel had looked into that area about technology in reference to the diaspora.
I have not, but actually one of my colleagues at George Washington University, Jennifer Brinkerhoff, studies diasporas and the Egyptian diaspora and has actually looked at their use of technology and the internet to connect.
And you should also connect with Kathleen Newland, who is here, who runs our diaspora work here at the Migration Policy Institute, or Susanna, who is here, who might be able to help you as well. Okay. Well, I just want to say one thing. This is one of the best panels we've had at the Migration Policy Institute in my term here. It's one of the best panels, but it is certainly the best audience we've had. Nobody's left. Everybody asked the question. I mean, it, you know, the room is warm. It's a moderator's dream. So, look, I just want to close by thanking again the Foundation for Child Development and Ruby Takanishi, not just for advancing this project, but advancing this field. And I want to thank the new president of the Foundation for Child Development, Deborah Phillips, who is very ardently supportive of this project. As you noted, there are two things on your chair. There's our book, which is for free, but there's also an invitation to a symposium that we're going to be holding on January 17th, which will be an all-day symposium. It'll be here at MPI, in which we'll go deeper into education issues, into health issues, and into immigration issues as they pertain to young children of immigrants, all young children of immigrants from ages birth to 12. We are going to have a number of the most prominent scholars in the field. A number of the most prominent scholars in the field, as well as key people from the administration, our ideas to say, what does the research base today mean for the policies of the going forward in the second term of the Obama administration? And I hope to see many of you back here early next month. And have a happy holiday.
For more information on the Migration Policy Institute's Young Children of Black Immigrants Research Initiative, please visit www.migrationpolicy.org/CBI.